2,000 years of church and world history, and this is the fourth part as we look at the greatest century of persecution in the 20th century. History tells us what has worked and what has not. We need to develop the ability to recognize these lessons in every area of life. Histories are a true school for learning how to order our lives, said John Calvin. And the Apostle Paul said these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things. But Revelation 11:15 reminds us of the ultimate consummation of all history. The kingdoms of the world will become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. That is where history is going. All nations will come and worship before Christ. I have summarized the 20th century as the greatest century of persecution. It started with the Anglo-Boer War, which we looked at last week, this terrible conflict which our country was caught up in, which really was devastating, a lot of courage on both sides, but what terrible, terrible consequences. And that the 20th century began with concentration camps, scorched earth, and horrific death toll amongst the Boer women and children in particular, which had long-ranging implications for this country. But tonight we come up to the First World War. The First World War, I would say, was the most catastrophic disaster that ever befell civilization in history. Before 1914, the Christians ruled the world, either Catholic or Protestant or Orthodox, but Christians ruled the world. And aside from the Ottoman Empire, there was no persecution of the church, effectively, because Christians dominated all these areas. But the First World War eroded family stability by conscripting women into factory work. Who was bringing up the children? The men were out fighting, sometimes entire villages being wiped out, and all the men of some villages being wiped out in a single battle sometimes. Destroyed the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, which, although the Austrian-Hungarian Empire was a great enemy of the Reformation and was the cause of the 30 Years' War and did a lot of other bad things, yet the Austro-Hungarian Empire had been a bulwark which had resisted the threat of the Turks for centuries and had kept Europe safe from the Muslim Turks. So the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the carving it up by the Versailles Treaty into so many different parts, most of which fell to the communists. And the collapse of the German and the Russian empires was absolutely catastrophic. These created a vacuum which socialist dictatorships exploited. So the First World War was absolutely catastrophic. To see the Christian nations turning on themselves, and the way it divided didn't make sense. Why would Protestant Britain be allied to Catholic France and Humanist France and Orthodox Russia? And why would Protestant America be fighting against Protestant Germany? And what on earth did South Africa have to do with this? And how did we get involved in this conflict? So it all started with a Serbian terrorist murdering an Austrian Archduke and his wife, the heir to the Austrian throne, in Sarajevo. Funny how that little town has caused a lot of trouble and hasn't stopped yet. But just think how the heirs of Europe were fighting one another. These were the grandchildren of Queen Victoria. Here you've got King George of England, and you've got Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany. They're cousins. In fact, they look like one another. Can you tell which is which? They are cousins, and literally had brothers fighting brothers. How did the, and bear in mind that Britons are actually Saxons. Both the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes all come from effectively what today is Germany and Denmark. And how on earth was it that the German royal family of England, which, let's face it, Queen Victoria was German, and so was Prince Albert, and so their descendants, German, and how they're ending up fighting against Germans and for the French, who were always their historic enemies, and the Russians for that matter. The British marched off to war. The French marched off to war. There was great enthusiasm. The women ended up in the factories, which was absolutely catastrophic. I mean, just think. Here the women are making munitions that are going to be killing many of their men. And they're producing bigger and bigger and bigger cannons, and South Africa gets involved. Now, these men are in British uniforms, and 12 years before they were fighting the British. This is extraordinary that General Smuts, Field Marshal Smuts, and Field Marshal Porter, fine Boer commanders who had done extraordinarily brilliant work in fighting against the British Empire, that they felt themselves cornered into having to fight for Britain. But the Chief of the Defence Force, General Beyers actually resigned rather than fight against their German friends in invading German Southwest Africa. And General Christian de Wet, one of the greatest heroes of the Angry Boer War, went to prison. And General De La Rey got shot by South African police by accident at the roadblock. And so South African troops lining up to go and fight in Southwest Africa. And these massive battleships, the dreadnoughts, which the West had poured beyond comprehension. This was the first great arms race. Germany and Britain and France and America were just building bigger, 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 and bigger ships and more impressive armaments and heavier armor and bigger guns. Funny thing is, these ships were barely used in the war. They were so big that nobody dared risk them. So they basically, most of the money had gone to the Navy, and the Navy's played the smallest role in the war. Here you can see the chivalry of the war. Here's the Austrian Air Force having sunk an Italian submarine, dropping a dinghy to help the people and then picking up some of the survivors. That was one of the last wars where there's a bit of chivalry, it would seem. And the last great knights of the air. Here they were fighting in these triplanes and biplanes, and these were mostly ex-cavalry officers. But all kinds of evils came in the First World War, like gas warfare, fire, flamethrowers, tanks, terrible, terrible things. Here you can see the countries that were involved in the conflict, and it spread as far as Southwest Africa, Tanganyika, all the way up to Cameroon. It was all over the world, literally, how the conflict spread. And to think that Africa became a battleground, and it had nothing really to do with us anyway. All of these battles really were to do with Europe. And it was Austria and Serbia who had the complaints with one another, legitimately. How on earth did it suck in Russia and Germany and France and Britain and America and South Africa? It just got out of control. Now, this shows you the battle lines. In the first year of the war, the German army basically won the war in the first 2 months. And any time up to then, that would have been the end of the war. They had gone in, they'd defeat the French army. The French army was finished, and they were within just a few kilometers of Paris. As you can see, that's how close they got to Paris. At this point, in the 1870 war, when Bismarck fought the French, that was the end of it. Sued for peace, and this is the way wars fought. The first one to get their soldiers deployed and to win their battles, and that was normally the end of it. But something had happened in between since 1870. And this massive industrial revolution meant that although France was defeated, Britain was not. So Britain was able to pour in men and machinery in order to fill the gap that the French had lost. The French army had 100,000 desertions in 1 month. By September 1914, the war had only been going a month, and in that month they had a record 100,000 desertions. They had mutinies. The French army was shattered. It was finished. The war was over. You would have thought. But not really. Because they just had more men to pull on. They just kept drafting more and more men, and they kept pouring them in. And they called this the meat factory, how they would just keep churning it in like you're going through some producing... No, mincemeat. The mincemeat machine. It just... They poured the people in. They didn't find most of the bodies. There was so much destruction. I mean... They've got some gravestones out there, but I mean, honestly, they didn't find most of the bodies. There's just too much explosions and destruction and mud and mire. Even today, who knows how many bodies are still out there under all those farms. The French army morale was shattered. Let's face it, the French had their highest points militarily under Napoleon. But after Waterloo, it was pretty downhill. They won a couple of victories against the Arabs out the Foreign Legion and so on, and did a few things in Southeast Asia, but they weren't able to win another European war, not in their own anymore. Now they needed Britain and America to pull them out. There's 110,000 Americans buried in France, for example, which, as many Americans said, we should give France back to Germany. They're not grateful. You know, why on earth did we go there? Yes. Sarajevo, right there, in what today would be, Sarajevo is what today is Kosovo. It's right next to Serbia. Now, at that stage, it wasn't Serbia, but there was a Serbian minority there, and it was Austro-Hungarian Empire. It's definitely part of Yugoslavia. But remember, Yugoslavia didn't exist until 1919. Mm-hmm. The Versailles Treaty created Yugoslavia primarily to be a power against Austria. Now, Austria had been one of the greatest empires. At one time, the Austro-Hungarian Empire controlled most of Europe, and in fact, the Americas too.
And their emperors were usually the emperors of the Holy Roman
Empire. That's right, the Habsburgs. Mm-hmm. And so Charles V was a Habsburg, for example. He controlled Spain, all the Spanish powers, every territory they had in the Americas. And so Austria, for all their crimes against the Reformation, had at least kept Europe safe from the Turks. Mm-hmm. But to destroy Austria effectively and turn it into a very small country and to hand most of these into the hands of groups that could never resist the Muslims and would not be any significant power, that was a disastrous move. And Russia, for all Russia's crimes, yet the Orthodox Church there had been a bulwark against Islam as well. They had, where the Mongol hordes had taken a hold of Asia and threatened Europe at one stage, they'd beaten them back, and they had Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan in subjection. And so Russia was a stabilizing influence under the Orthodox regime of the Romanovs, and so the Tsars were, again, they were better than what came afterwards. The Tsars were far preferable to the Commissars, just as Austria is far preferable to the Turks and all the communist regimes that took over in that area. So Europe in 1914 was nowhere close to perfect. But with every passing year since, you look back and you think, well, it's a lot better than what's come since. Europe in 1914 could have experienced spiritual revival and might have gone a different direction. It was at least nominally Christian, some of it thoroughly Christian, others Catholic, Orthodox, but nevertheless, Europe in 1914 was civilization. They had crushed the slave trade. Just think that at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, 1815, Europe had abolished the slave trade. Every European nation except for Portugal had signed the abolition of the slave trade in 1815. That's an amazing achievement. They were the first continent to do so. And here, Europe had been a tremendous influence in ending slavery, bringing stability, ending piracy, which is coming back again, have you noticed? Slavery and piracy is coming back. This is what happens, because all these great empires which had actually brought civilization and stability to the world now were destroying themselves. And you can just see there must have been extremely evil people behind the scenes to have brought about this collapse. There's nothing could have destroyed Christendom except Christendom fighting themselves, basically. The battle line after 1914 stayed the same for the next almost 4 years, and it only changed a little bit around here in 1980. 1980, there's a bit more movement. Why? Several things happened in 1917. The Russian Empire collapsed, so the German army was able to move over 1 million men from the Eastern Front over to the Western Front, and the Americans came into the war, and they were able to bring in vast amounts of fresh troops and enormous amount of weaponry. Because basically, the First World War was at a stalemate, and from 1914 to 1918, the battle lines didn't move more than 4 miles either way. But there was one solid fortification trenches from the British Channel down to Switzerland, all the way through Belgium, France to Switzerland. A solid line of trenches. No more could you outmaneuver. And you've got to understand this to understand why in the Second World War everything was blitzkrieg and lightning war and frost strikes, because nobody wanted to get stuck in the mess of the First World War again. And bad as the Second World War was, the death toll in the Second World War is nowhere close to as bad as the First World War in terms of soldiers killed in action. First World War was vastly worse. And so lightning war actually lowered the death toll. It was far more precise, and it didn't get caught up in this mindless over-the-top and charge machine gun nests and get an entire division wiped out in a few minutes, which literally they did. So nobody can question their courage, but you certainly can question the intelligence of the tactics. The big problem of the First World War is you had 20th century weapons with 19th century tactics. They hadn't adjusted the tactics to keep up with the weapons. Because now, the sea power's great, but the sea powers didn't de-engage one another. They were so terrified. In fact, Winston Churchill, the first Lord of the Admiralty, called Admiral Jellicoe, who is the head of the Admiral of the Fleet, the one man who could lose the war in a single day. If he got into a scrap with the German High Seas Fleet and lost it, that would lose the war. Why? Britain's an island. Britain needs a strong navy if they are to protect the island. And Britain's number one tactic in the First World War was starve Germany into submission. So they had their surface fleet preventing any trade with Germany. Now, America, for example, had huge amount of trade with Germany before the First World War. Massive. In fact, the Americans were agreed that they should be neutral. But after several years of the Royal Navy preventing American trade with Germany, now they had no more economic ties to Germany, and they'd sold so many things on credit to Britain that they, after a while, the businessmen had a vested interest in Britain winning the war, because otherwise they wouldn't be paid all these debts. You can see how just sheer economics pushed America out of the neutrality which all of their presidents had held to up till then. The Monroe Doctrine, Europe's not allowed to get involved here in the Americas, but we're not allowed to get involved in Europe. Washington said, do not get involved in Europe's wars, never get entangled in any alliances with Europe. We are separate from Europe, have nothing to do with it in terms of military or in terms of wars or alliances. So there was one big naval battle at Jutland, and this is when the German High Seas Fleet came out, and they actually surprised the British Navy quite well, and they had a massive battle. And in fact, the German Navy won it in the sense of the numbers of ships sunk. They sunk a lot more British ships, killed a lot more British people, sunk more tonnage than the British sunk of theirs. But while the Germans could say we won it in terms that we destroyed more of them than they destroyed of us, and the gunnery was superior, and the armor was superior, and it proved that many of the ships were every bit as good as the British ones, but after that they retreated back to base because they knew they couldn't risk losing the High Seas Fleet. And so the British could say they won because they managed to still maintain the dominance of the seas and continue the stranglehold of Germany's ports, preventing any trade, which meant that Germany was forced to counterattack with the U-boats to try and undermine Britain's trade. And as Winston Churchill said, both the First and the Second World War, the U-boats almost cost them the war. Just a little bit more, and the U-boats might have succeeded in bringing Britain to the knees, because they sank so many merchant marine ships that Britain, in trying to starve Germany, was almost starved themselves by the counter-blockade. So one was using surface fleet, the other was using U-boats, but I mean, basically speaking, it was a tit-for-tat destruction of one another's economy. This is a story of the First World War. Here you've got the last cavalry units seeing the first air units. I mean, this is just so poignant. And many of the men like Baron von Richthofen were cavalry officers who after a while realized, look, when you've got trenches and you've got landmines and you've got barbed wire and you've got machine gun nests, the day of the cavalry is over, at least in this section of the war. So many of the cavalry officers switched to the air. The funny thing is, at the very beginning, they of course didn't have radio connections, so they used to get carrier pigeons and they put a message of what they'd seen and send a carrier pigeon. The pigeon would fly back to base and give, and that's how they passed information from the spotter planes back home. Doesn't sound like the most advanced ways of doing it, but it wasn't long before these planes were not just, remember, planes had only been invented in 1903. This is 11 years later, and now planes, which are basically canvas and string with bits of wire, and they're not very substantial. And at first they were throwing darts at one another, and they were using revolvers, and then they went to machine guns, and after a while they'd fixed machine guns. The earliest planes, funnily enough, the earliest planes actually were having two seats, and the one in front would be the one in front would be the officer handling the machine gun, the one behind would be the chauffeur who would be driving, and you'd have a non-commissioned officer flying, and you'd have an officer handling the machine gun, because that's the way it was. Noblemen didn't drive, they had a chauffeur to drive, but then they realized that, you know, many of them, left, turn right, goodness me, you're too slow. So after a while they realized, listen, throw out the non-commissioned officer, we're going to do both, because we need better coordination between movement of the plane and handling the machine gun. So the two-seated planes changed into the one-seater within about a year and a half, and this broke down all kinds of social barriers, because, of course, officers had to fly And up till then, the idea of an officer or a gentleman actually driving his own car or flying his own plane was unthinkable. These are some of the greatest air aces in history. You'll see their pictures all over the American Air Force displays in the Air and Space Museum. And the German Air Force really had some of the finest air aces. And to this day, the top 150 fighter aces in the First and Second World War are German. And the greatest of all is Baron von Richthofen, who has the biggest picture on the wall in the American Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Must grant the Americans at least they do give credit where credit is due, even to the enemies. Baron von Richthofen was a nobleman and a hunter, and he was a cavalry officer who ended up fighting. In 15 months, he shot down over 80 enemy planes. 15 months. He didn't have the whole 4 years. He just had a 15-month window. When he was shot down by Australian ground fire, actually, he's never shot down by air fire. He was chasing a Canadian pilot, Brown, who got the credit, but later on they realized he couldn't have got him. It was Australian ground fire. The battle went too close to the lines, and the Australians did a full guard of honor, and this just shows an Anglican pastor chaplain taking the honors at the cemetery and 21-gun salute. And this just shows that even in a brutal war with gas warfare, flamethrowers, bombing of cities, all kinds of horrible things, yet there was still respect for one another, which in the Second World War was heavily eroded. One of the most extraordinary parts of the campaign, from my perspective, especially because we've got the South African interest, is the battle in Tanganyika, Germany, East Africa. Of course, they had British to the north in Kenya, they had British to the south in northern Rhodesia, they had the Belgians coming in also from the Congo. And General von Letlow Forbeck was one of the most extraordinary gentlemen who, with an extremely small force, he had only about 250 German officers and NCOs and a few thousand of the African Askari, and with that he whipped the South Africans and he whipped the Rhodesians and he whipped the British and the Belgians and everyone else who came against him, and they marched one side to the other. They made forays into Portuguese East Africa, they made forays into northern Rhodesia. They gave General Botha and General Smuts an absolute miserable time. And this is, for example, interesting early anti-aircraft technique, using a Maxim machine gun, lying on your back and turning it upwards. I wouldn't want to have to fight a plane that way. And they had different positions all over the... You can recognize a Serengeti plain where you get those hundreds of thousands and even millions of zebra and wildebeest migrating. Well, this was the scene of the war. And here's a whole lot of the South Africans chasing after General von Letlow Forbeck, which is quite funny, because here the Boers had run rings around the British using the very same tactics that now General von Letlow Forbeck used on the South Africans. And you would have thought that General Smuts would have picked this up and would have handled it better. But here's one of the British positions taken by the Askari of the East African Army. And so they ended the war victorious. In fact, they happily marched in northern Rhodesia. And at the end of the war was over. They got the cable telegram, and the British actually had to come over to them with a white flag and say, you know, the war's over. And they said, yes, we do know it. And they said, you know, that the Kaiser's abdicated. And they said, yes, we know that. They said, there's an armistice. Yes, we do know that. They said, well, you need to hand your rifles and your swords. And the general said, you've never beaten us in battle. You want a rematch? Come along and get them. And they said, no, that's okay. You can keep your guns and your swords. So the East African, the German East African force had the only victory parade through the Brandenburg Gates at the end of the war. They came back in full honors, under weapons, with their flags. They surrendered no weapons at all. And they were honored for that. And in a war that was filled with so much cruelty and horror on the Western Front and the Eastern Front, you just think of the Battle of Tannenberg, where the Russians lost over 1 million men in one battle. Just colossal in terms of deaths and in terms of wounded and captured. Massive, massive, massive destruction. In East Africa, you at least had honor, chivalry, and an extremely honorable enemy on both sides. But the worst thing that came out of the First World War, aside from the Christians playing auto-genocide with one another, was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, brought about the Soviet Union, which killed over 66 million people, most of them Christians. Here is this rabble-rouser, Vladimir Lenin, in St. Petersburg, rousing up the masses. And amongst all the victims was the entire Romanov family murdered, including the four daughters of the Tsar and his young son, who was, in fact, a hemophiliac anyway, one who bled internally. And just the brutality and cruelty of this. Interesting that the Russian Orthodox churches conferred sainthood on the entire family and named them as martyrs, which in a real sense they were Christian martyrs at the hands of Marxist thugs. In fact, if you go back to Catherine the Great, she was completely German as well, who was one of the key and one of the most magnificent monarchs in the history of the Romanovs, and she was in no way Russian. So the interesting thing is the German royal family dominated the whole of Europe, and in fact the Austrian and German royal family basically covered all of Europe, right down to Spain, Greece, the whole lot. It was all basically German or Austrian royal family, all the way up through the Scandinavian countries too. So this made it even more inexplicable that you had cousins and brothers fighting one another in the First World War, which how it ever got to that is beyond comprehension. Now, the murder of the Russian royal family is an extremely important event in history, because what the Russians are saying is this, the communists are saying is, we're not going back. No more monarchy, no more respect for life or property, and to not just kill the Tsar, but his whole family, right down to the children. Absolutely despicable act in cold blood, and this cold-blooded murder is one of the worst events imaginable. And it just was a foretaste of what was coming for the rest of the century. This is, the royal families of Europe were dying out, and at the end of it, there wasn't much left. The German Empire, the Russian Empire, the Austrian Empire, finished. The Bulgarian royal family also overthrown very quickly after. The Romanian royal family, just one after the other. It was just destruction upon destruction. If these royal families could have seen what was at stake and who was pulling the strings leading them into war, they would have realized they were actually signed their own death warrant by getting basically the suicide of their own nations and kingdoms and empires by entering into this war, which was fratricidal. It was, you can't call it a civil war in one sense, but another sense it was a civil war. Because I've heard some people describe the First and Second World Wars as Europe's auto-genocides, where Europe decided to destroy one another. Could they have but looked into the future a few decades and recognized the threat of communism and the threat of Islam, which even overshadows it, they would have spared their weapons and their energy to fight the real enemy and not fight one another. And I think this must again remind Christians. Many people wonder why I don't spend more time fighting against different denominations and church heads who we disagree with. Well, we don't have the time and the luxury. No, I don't agree with all the things done by a whole lot of different Christian groups, but honestly, until we've beaten all the Muslims and the communists and the atheists and the humanists and the evolutionists, I don't think we've got the luxury to fight one another. We've got to see the big picture and stop fighting our brethren while we've got a life and death battle for civilization itself. Well, this is the beginning of the worst threat that Christianity ever faced. If people thought that Nero and Rome was a problem, if they thought that the Vikings were a problem, if they thought that the Huns and the Mongols were a problem, nothing compared to communism. And these are the Marx brothers, Stalin, Lenin, and Trotsky. But the funny thing is, as soon as Lenin died, Stalin turned on Trotsky. Trotsky was head of the Red Army, and Trotsky got axed, literally. He ended up with an axe in his head in Mexico City, killed by the KGB's predecessor, the NKVD. So Stalin managed to get rid of them all. I wish I had the picture. I'm still looking for it. There's a book called The Disappearing Commissar. It's got a picture of Stalin with all of his different commissars around him. And then each picture, it gets less. And of course, they couldn't do it digitally, but they had to paint out each person as he fell into disfavor, and he got executed, and he got off to Siberia. Yeah. And after a while, there's just Stalin there. And these are official pictures in their different yearbooks, and literally how one commissar got wiped out, and literally the same picture. And it just got less and less until he is the only one. He killed them all. All of his best, all of his friends, and just to look at this. These were the top three, and Stalin killed Lenin. And the only reason, I mean, killed Trotsky, and the only reason didn't kill Lenin is because Lenin died first, before he could get around to him, I guess. So they look like they're smiling away there. Let me just remind you, there's a lot of people who think Lenin was good, but Stalin was bad. Lenin was just as bad. He just didn't have as long to prove it. He killed millions, not just 100,000. Lenin killed millions, even though he only had a few years before he died. Stalin just had longer, so he managed to kill more. Concentration camps, massacres, labor camps, the Gulag Archipelago, forced famines. You remember what Stalin said, the death of a million is just a statistic. The death of one person is a tragedy, but the death of millions only a statistic. And so just look at the spontaneous demonstration of support for Stalin. And everyone's got identical printed placards. You can just see the enthusiasm of the workers. No, every communist country does this. You'll just see suddenly a whole lot of pictures of some chap there, like people marching for Mugabe or for Chairman Mao or for Jacob Zuma or whoever. This is just Marxism. You suddenly have a whole lot of people there. All the school children are lined up and they've all got a picture of Fidel Castro and a Cuban flag. Yeah. Nobody looks enthusiastic, but they've got to be there. Well, 1919, very significant, Karl Barth's commentary on Romans is published. Now, Karl Barth was a great man. He was a great theologian. Karl Barth was what they call a neo-orthodox, neo-fundamentalist. He tried to go back to the Bible in a time of radical liberalism and where they were just cutting the Bible to pieces. And this is something we need to understand theologically. Before the First World War, the high critics had come in. And you had the people who were picking away at the Bible. No, this is mythology and that didn't happen. And they just chopping away at the Old Testament, the book of Genesis. So a lot of the foundations of the church had already been eroded. Externally, the churches were strong. The people in the pew, their faith was still strong. But the theological cultures were already eroding the faith. Already before the First World War. And this explains a lot of what could have happened. But Karl Barth was a counterattack. He was saying, this is the word of God. But the weakness was, he used subjective arguments. He said, it's the word of God to me. God speaks to me through the word of God. Maybe it's got scientific errors. Maybe this history is not right. But the fact is, it becomes the word of God in our experience. And so he had a very existential argument. He was standing up for the word of God. But unfortunately, he had handed in his guns at the door, so to speak. He had abdicated. He had conceded some of the principles of the opponents. And while he was standing for orthodoxy, it's called neo-orthodoxy because he had basically conceded that there could be errors in the Bible. He didn't stand strongly on inerrancy. He stood for the experience of the Word of God. It's the Word of God to me. God speaks to me through it. Which a lot of people today do too. You can see a lot of people have got existential arguments. Well, I don't care about that, but the fact is I know what God's done for me. And you can't argue with a person's testimony. But it's not as powerful as the Bible's, the Word of God, inerrant, it's accurate in everything, history, science, the position of the Creation Museum, the position of Christians who today are beyond fundamentalists. But you can see what we were talking about earlier, how 1910, publishing of the Fundamentals, 1919, a publishing on the Commentary on Romans by Karl Barth, they're both the same sort of thing. They're trying to defend the faith in a retreating action. Christianity is on a retreat. And it's making a stand here and a stand there, but it's basically giving a lot of field to the enemy. So while this man's a good man who meant well, yet it was giving ground to the enemy. 1921, the first radio broadcast. Now this is a very significant event. And do you know there were many, many, many Christians who criticized it and said this is wrong. The devil is the prince of the power of the air. Christians should have nothing to do with the airwaves. Radio is a tool of the devil. And it may be hard for us to believe right now, but there's a lot of Christians who opposed Christians getting on the airwaves as though they'd done something wrong and something immoral about using broadcasting. I think those are the kind of people like that Pope who criticized the printing press, the tool of the devil, when the printing press came out. There's some people who think technology is our enemy, and yet technology has often been given by God. Martin Luther had no problem using his technology for the Lord. He wouldn't hesitate to use radio or desktop publishing of the internet, but the first Christian broadcast by radio was very heavily criticized. 1922, absolutely horrific Islamic destruction of a city, the destruction of Smyrna, the last Christian Christian city in Asia Minor. Now remember, Greece had taken a whole of Turkey. Turkey, what today is called Turkey, was actually part of the Hellenistic world. It was Greece. It was the Byzantine Empire. It was Christian. From the first century on, Christianity was heavily in what today became called Turkey. Smyrna, based about over there, was the last Christian city in Asia. And there you can see it's now renamed Izmir. But in 1922, the Turkish army under Ataturk went in and destroyed a city of 300,000 people. And the disgraceful fact is that the British Navy, the American Navy, the French Navy, the Italian Navy sat off the coast and watched. Took these pictures, but they didn't get involved. In fact, even worse than that, sorry to say, every one of those navies refused to take Greek Christian refugees onto their ships. And they pushed them away.
Why?
They were afraid to upset the Turks. Fear of the Muslims. 1922. Why? Turkey was a defeated enemy. Most of the Holy Land areas were in the hands of Christian countries now. France controlled Syria. Britain controlled Palestine. What were they afraid of? But they were just groveling before the Muslims already. This is one of the greatest disgraces that the Christians stood by, and just as Christian, Latin, Roman Catholic Europe stood by while Constantinople was destroyed by the Turks in 1852, now you've got 1922, the last day. And remember, Smyrna is one of the honored churches in the Book of Revelation. This is where John the Apostle was bishop. This is where Polycarp was martyred for Christ. Smyrna had a great Christian heritage. And yet to think that Europe stood by and did nothing. This stands to me in the same light as the destruction of Rhodesia, destruction of South Africa, Christian outposts where the West just stands by and doesn't want to get involved. Very disgraceful. Or the Christians in Biafra being wiped out, for example, in the Biafran Civil War, or the Christians being attacked in Nuba Mountains in southern Sudan. There's many examples like it, but the biggest curse of the 20th century has been cowardice, criminal cowardice by Western governments. 1924, Joseph Stalin replaces Lenin, who's died, and Joseph Stalin becomes the biggest mass murderer in history up to that stage, later eclipsed by Mao Zedong. He destroys 48,000 churches and he slaughters millions of Christians. In fact, if you go into Guinness Book of Records, you'll get the most horrific results. And we've got on our shelf, for example, a Christian World Encyclopedia on our that red, huge doorstop of a book on the second shelf. Christian World Encyclopedia documents the millions of Christians slaughtered and the 48,000 churches destroyed under Joseph Stalin. And yet, at this very moment, and if you haven't seen the Behind the Big News video, which is very helpful, they show how there were these low-life New York Times reporters in. And Malcolm Muggeridge also reports how many of the London newspaper journalists were out there in Russia at this time, turning a blind eye to all the massacres and all the organized famines and the killing of 6 million Ukrainian farmers by famine in 1 year. And they wouldn't report, and they were just giving glowing reports about how Uncle Joe is making record amounts of factories and tractors and the five-year plan and all this nonsense. And all of these humanistic art glorifying Marxism, just disgusting pictures, absolutely amazing nonsense that they were built. But the gulags, these are just some of the Russian concentration camps and the people who suffered under them. 1931, one of the most significant Christian authors of the 20th century, C.S. Lewis, was converted. This is an Oxford lecturer who later became a Cambridge professor, who was a real academic and a mega skeptic, a serious atheist before, and his conversion later in life is extraordinary. He produced the Chronicles of Narnia. He produces all these great books like Near Christianity and the Screwtape Letters. And in a letter to one girl, C.S. Lewis explained the whole Narnia series like this. The magician's nephew talks about creation and how evil entered into the world, into Narnia. The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe tells about the crucifixion and the resurrection. Prince Caspian tells about the restoration of the true religion after corruption, Reformation. The Horseman's Boy tells about the calling and conversion of a heathen. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader tells about spiritual life, especially in Reaper Cheap. The Silver Chair tells about the continuing war with the powers of darkness. And The Last Battle tells about the coming of the Antichrist, the ape, and the end of the world and the Last Judgment. So, C.S. Lewis has written, in the seven books of Narnia, he's written a Christian message to a post-Christian world, to a world that's so secular, he's coming in with a outflanking movement. And it's a brilliant tool, and it's amazing how many people even involved in the making of these films don't realize they're actually giving Christian parables, Christian allegories and analogies over, and they often are so blind they can't even see that they're helping to proclaim the gospel through these films. In fact, the director himself was confused. He said, he's surprised that some people think these are Christian films, and he obviously just hasn't realized the implications of what he's doing. It's an example of the stones crying out. 1934, Cameron Townsend begins Wycliffe Bible Translators, which translates God's Word into hundreds of different languages. Magnificent work Wycliffe does. But then, if the First World War wasn't bad enough, we now have the Second World War, which is basically round two, because the Versailles Treaty was so ruinous. It brought Germany to total depression, which dragged the whole of Europe and even America and South Africa down to the Great Depression worldwide, because you can't destroy such a major engine, locomotive that was running Europe's economy without a ripple effect hitting everyone else. So the vindictiveness of the French in particular in insisting on putting such ruinous reparations on Germany that they were basically compelled to run more money off the printing press, which started this whole inflation out of control, which resulted in wheelbarrows of money to buy a loaf of bread, and destroyed the country. And of course, you had the bankers taking people's homes, and many of the people who had fought at the front and maybe died or been crippled came back to, or didn't come back. Their wives or widows were turned out of their homes, and the bankers took more. So the social destruction of Germany at the end of the First World War, and the abdication of Kaiser, and the collapse of the German Empire, and the loss of the colonies, and all of this, where they decide to blame one country for the stupidity of all of the countries who'd been involved in this really wicked, foolish, mindless war, just had a ripple effect that hurt everyone. And, of course, it made absolutely inevitable that there would be a rerun. And World War II was that. But the results of World War II was even worse than the First World War, because it resulted in expansion of communist control over most of Central and Eastern Europe, including Albania, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, East Germany, Poland, which people call Eastern Europe. Correctly speaking, it's Central Europe. Russia's Eastern Europe. This was Central Europe. The heart of Europe was handed over to Marxism. Well, we learned a new word in the Second World War, Blitzkrieg, lightning war. The German High Command were absolutely determined not to repeat the mistakes of the First World War and get bogged down in trench warfare. So everything was designed to be fast, furious, quick, primarily to save lives. And it did save lives. They innovated the first parachutists in history. And the German parachute battalions were absolutely extraordinary, how they captured Eben and Menel, for example, the strongest fortress of the Belgians, with parachute drops and using gliders. And the Blitzkrieg was in 4 hours they took Denmark, in 2 weeks they took Norway, in about a week and a half they took Belgium. They defeated France in 3 weeks. It was, the world had never seen anything like this before. Such fast, furious, brilliant advances. Here's the French army doing what they basically had to do in each war, which is surrendering. There were the odds were against, and if America didn't come in on the on the western side, Germany would have won, no question. It's Mussolini was the kind of ally that Germany could have done without. Everything he did basically was a disaster, so that if Germany didn't have Italy as an ally, they might have won the war, but it sucked up so many of their troops, because this little Caesar out of his time basically wasted so many of the resources in trying to pull his irons out of the fire. Everything he got involved in, he messed up. His war against, his invasion of Greece, disaster. His invasion of Egypt, disaster. Everything they did, catastrophe. But the only good thing was 94,000 Italians who were captured in Addis Ababa by the South African army when South Africa liberated Abyssinia, they came to the Transvaal, and they built quite a few of our roads and quite a few of the nice passes. I believe that even quite a few of our passes out of the Cape. Italian war prisoners did do quite a lot of our road construction at that time. So that's about the only good thing they did for our country. Well, first of all, you wouldn't have communism. They would have killed communism in Russia very easily. And in fact, they were well on the way to when America got involved in the war and poured in mega billions of dollars worth of equipment. Tens of thousands of tanks and trucks and planes into Russia. Russia had no chance. Their factories could never have manufactured the quality of weaponry that America provided. Russia doesn't like to give acknowledgement to it, but if it wasn't for Uncle Roosevelt and Roosevelt providing all this huge amount of weaponry, they wouldn't have had a chance. So if Germany had won the war, Germany being the dynamic country it was, wouldn't have tolerated a dictatorship for long. That dictatorship could have lasted for a while, but the people in Europe are resilient. They don't put up with dictatorships for too long. So that wouldn't have lasted. But remember, Germany had zero interest in the West. It was just to prevent an attack from the West that they took that. And they were immediately offering, look, we'll withdraw here if you give us freedom in the East. So the interest wasn't in Western Europe. So everything that Western Europe achieved at the end of the war, for the loss of a few million lives, was actually pointless, because they could have got it without a loss of a single life, because Germany didn't want Norway. They didn't want France and Holland and Belgium. All they wanted was a free hand in the East, and they offered to withdraw from there almost immediately. We'll withdraw if you just sign this and leave us alone. And that's all they wanted, to be left alone. So I'm not one of those who believes that the world would be an absolute disaster if they'd won the war. In fact, I think that the world couldn't have been worse than what resulted from the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And I don't in any sense question the courage of the men who fought in it. My father fought in the 8th Army. And I don't question the courage of many of the British people and Americans who fought, thinking they were fighting for civilization, Christianity, and all of that. But the fact is, the people on the other side thought they were fighting for civilization, Christianity, too. In fact, mm-hmm. the German soldiers had what? Gott mit uns on their mm-hmm. belt buckles. Mm-hmm. They weren't a bunch of pagans. There were some pagans up in the government, as we have pagans in our government, as the British have pagans in their government, and there were some godless heathens in their administrations, as there were on each side. But most of the men in the field, on both sides, were real good believing people. And this is the tragedy. You see the pictures, and I've seen pictures that I think few people have. I must get them in here too. I've got to track those down. But I remember being shown of these huge church services. Hundreds of thousands of German soldiers kneeling in prayer while some chaplain is leading them in prayer before they're going and fighting in the Eastern Front. Now, those pictures are not very common to be shown, because people would prefer to act like God was on our side and all the others were unbelievers. That's not true. The trouble is, believers in Britain and America were allied with unbelievers in Russia against believers in Germany. And believers in Germany were allied with some pretty wicked people also in Mussolini's crowd and other things like that too. So you had some bad alliances on both sides, which doesn't make sense. Well, as my father was involved in North African Desert, my grandfather too, on the Africa Corps side, I'm interested particularly in North African Desert. Look at the sandstorm coming in. And you know, you can just imagine what it would be like in those situations.
No, he doesn't know what it is yet.
Well, the fact that he's standing there indicates he doesn't really understand what's coming as well. This was the kind of conditions where the British 8th Army were fighting against the Italians, and the South African 6th South African Division, which I had the joy of training under in the 1970s and 80s, they were up in North Africa and fought in Tobruk. And one of the greatest airborne operations in history was the German paratroopers conquering of Crete, which is absolutely remarkable. They came in, and these are the Junker 87s, which also was the first plane the South African Air Force used. Sorry, South African Airways used. And the first plane to fly between Cape Town and London was the Junker 87, a fine plane. And here you can see the paratroopers coming in. The German paratroopers were the world's leaders, and of course the British and Americans later adopted all of their techniques. And I don't think they often like to admit the fact that they didn't invent it. But the German paratroopers using the Smeisers, which are very modern, that was 1940 technology, which is about as up-to-date as you get. Again, the first troops to use camouflage, the first to use paratrooping, the first to use the shock troop tactics. You see destruction of a whole lot of the battleships by Luftwaffe actions. And here's the German Africa Corps marching into Tripoli to try and prevent the total rout of the Italians who had invaded Egypt for a few minutes and were chased out so fast that Hitler had to send a small token unit. I don't think they expected much to be done by Rommel's unit, but the Afrika Korps amazed everybody, not least of which the British, in how much they were able to achieve. Notice how at the beginning they came in with the pith helmets and some very old looking equipment. This does not look top of the line equipment. It looks like they gave the Afrika Korps a lot of the leftovers. This was a sideshow. This wasn't considered to be very important. But Erwin Rommel was a brilliant man who had fought the Italians in the First World War as an officer, scaling an insurmountable Alpine mountain to defeat the Italians. He is a genius in the lightning war against France. In fact, Erwin Rommel's tank corps is in the Guinness Book of Records for having advanced the fastest in combat of any combat unit in history. To this day, it hasn't been beaten. He covered, I forget the distance, it was something absolutely remarkable, like 78 miles in one day in constant combat, they advanced, which nobody's been able to beat. In opposed warfare, and just kept cutting through unit after unit after unit, destroying a record number of French tanks and so on the way. Well, Erwin Rommel's pathway to the east, that's the road to Egypt, and here you can see the German Spandaus being put into action, and some of these sidecars, which I think have been popularized in Hollywood movies, although if you look very closely in Indiana Jones movies, you'll see modern off-road bikes always being used here. They might put the cover there, but they're not using the old ones because the older ones couldn't do what they're doing in these films today. But these are just some of the showing. The biggest enemy was the desert. And I think this is one reason why there was a lot of compassion for one's enemies, because you realized you're both fighting the same elements. You needed... these are lines of British prisoners captured in the runs to the to Egypt, and the laying of more lines of supply through railways, which they normally use prisoners for. Here's the British and the Bren gun carriers. Many of these could have been South African and Rhodesian troops, also fought in similar uniforms. Major battles in Tobruk. Tremendous courage and sacrifice, but the trouble is, I think, on both sides, the men were being lied to as to why they were fighting. And if they had realized what they were doing, that actually at the end of it, the only winner at the end of the Second World War would be communism, these people would have stayed at home. But they were being lied to about the reasons, and I had a history teacher who's a member of parliament in Rhodesia, and he's a brilliant man, and he said, beware the victor's version. When we read the school textbook, he said, you can't believe this. This is written by the victor. It gives one side. He said, you've got to remember, remember at that stage, Britain was our enemy, trying to destroy us in Rhodesia. And he says, yeah, the British wrote this. And you've got to remember what they did to the Boers in the Anglo-Boer War. Obviously, they're going to turn everything around now. They're blaming the Germans for everything. All the same tactics they used on the Boers and that they're using on us now. They accuse me. He said, you've just got to understand, this is the nature of war. You've got a ministry of propaganda during the war, but you don't have a ministry of truth after the war to unravel the mess. And so there's lies, lies, and more lies told. And we've seen that ourselves. I mean, just think of the lies told about the war in Rhodesia and the war here in South Africa. Just that. And we face it now, so we shouldn't be too surprised that there's a lot of nonsense there. My father was very, very pro-British. He was so British, he even opposed Ian Smith's Declaration of Independence. He thought Rhodesia should be under the crown, even though he admitted that it would have been a disaster if they were, but I mean, he just couldn't kind of get past his allegiance to the British crown and to the empire and all this stuff. But the one thing my dad would never do would allow anyone to say anything bad of Erwin Rommel or the Afrika Korps. His respect for Field Marshal Rommel was sky high. He respected no one, not even Winston Churchill, as much as he respected Field Marshal Rommel. He said, gentleman, honorable man, honorable enemy, and he would get very angry with Hollywood films which would depict atrocities by the Afrika Korps, something like that. He said, rubbish, never happened. Honorable war, clean war, nothing like that happened. And the different stories that they gave of how during the war in North Africa they would have immediately after any combat there would be an automatic understood ceasefire so that the medics from both sides could go get the wounded, and they'd literally pass one another, greeting one another, and there would never be a violation of these ceasefires. And it was just, you know, for the compassion for the wounded, and there was just no violation of these sort of unwritten agreements, and the honour with which people were treated, and how Erwin Rommel treated many of the captured prisoners. In fact, the finest book on Erwin Rommel, best biography on him, which I've got on my shelf, was written by a British general who was a prisoner of his during the war, and he was so impressed to how well Rommel treated him and dealt with him, and his courage under fire, which he experienced. They were under fire from the British side, and he meets Erwin Rommel cheerfully munching a sandwich and offering help to them while they were literally under fire with the explosions around them. And this has been depicted very well in a major film made on Rommel, The Desert Fox, which I've got. It's a classic black and white film of Frederick Mason, is it? Mason? It was Charles Mason, sorry? James Mason, that's right. James Mason played the lead role. And very brilliant, and again, just showed the... It starts off with the British officer having to read out a command from Prime Minister Winston Churchill that the British troops in North Africa must stop speaking so glowingly of Field Marshal Rommel and must stop speaking so highly of the Afrika Korps. This doesn't help the fighting spirit when people respect their own enemy more than respect their own officers. And this is how the film starts, which is exactly true. My dad said that's what happened. We never respected our generals like we respected our enemy. And he said, you know, the British troops were good men, lions led by lambs. You know, what was lions led by donkeys? That was the British term. He said, we had donkeys as officers, we had good soldiers, but we had useless officers. He said, if we had some officers like the Germans had, then we really could have done something. And here's Field Marshal Rommel shortly before his death with his son. His son went on to become the celebrated mayor of Stuttgart for many, many, many years. And I know he's still living in Stuttgart, the States, but a very well-respected man and a great family heritage. This just shows you what you're dealing with in the desert. I mean, Crusader tank stuck in the mud. If the Americans hadn't come in, the Second World War would definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, have been a German victory. It's just the American involvement at that critical time that just changed the whole balance of power. Europe had had their seesaw battles, but normally countries didn't collapse and change as a result and get divided. And you took a little bit of territory off and assigned treaties, and they might have handed over this fort or that. But the colossal collapse of whole empires at the end of the First World War and the destruction of the whole of Central Europe in the Second World War was a disaster. And again, no question about the courage, the sincerity, the well-meaning of most of the soldiers on the ground. But the fact is, there were pawns in the hands of people who had another agenda. Churches burning. I cannot calculate how many thousands of churches were destroyed in Europe in the Second World War. The bombing. My mother was speaking about how the bombs would come from 1,000 bomber raids, and there would just rain destruction. It'd come out and there'd be nothing on top. Everything destroyed, just picking through the wreckage of homes. My mother was in Berlin in the first bombing in 1940. Absolute destruction. There she was in the circus, and next thing you've got all the animals stampeding and the people stampeding. And she was 7 years old and just about trampled to death in that bombing. And then they had to leave Berlin because the home was destroyed there, and then they went to Minden. And finally, after many bombings, Canadians took over. And horrific experiences. They were actually kicked out of their home, and the only thing they could take was what they could carry in a sleigh. baby brother was on a sleigh and he fell off in the snow, and literally the Canadians just came and said, well, you know, we want your house, you've got the nicest house in town, so that's going to be your officer's mess, and that was it.